Okay, welcome to another podcast, Rank Success podcast, in relation to police promotion, all things police promotion. And today I've got my first guest. I'm going to be talking about some insights, some thoughts and some reflection around promotion. So if you're someone who is aspiring to promotion to constable, to sergeant, to chief inspector, across UK forces at the moment, pin your ears back because you'll like our guest. It's my first guest on my Rank Success podcast. Our paths cross occasionally in London through various teaching and learning activities and interests that we share. And the individual concerned is Simon Foy. And I will ask Simon in a minute to introduce himself, do a little bit of a summary of his background, and then we'll get into some kind of discussion around all things promotion. I decided against asking a whole load of questions, and rather than that, we'll just do it in a discussion way, and hopefully I'll cover some of the themes that are interesting, and if you like it enough, maybe he'll come back again. So if I could just ask Simon to introduce himself and just share with our listeners some of your background.
Hi Steve, yeah, it's great to be here. It's fantastic to have an opportunity to talk about a subject that I'm interested in, and it's also great to be able to talk to you. And as you say, Steve, our paths have crossed occasionally and our universes come into collision once in a while. So let me just start off telling you a little bit about myself. I say Simon Foy, I did 30 years in the Met. I was lucky enough to retire in the Met after 30 years as a commander, or outside the Met, assistant chief constable rank. I was in ACPO ranks for just under 9 years, got promoted into commander in 2004, and operated at sort of senior strategic level in the service for 9 years. My sort of claim to fame, really, in terms of operational background, is the last 6 years of the service. I was really lucky that I managed to get the job in the Met that I wanted to have ever since I was quite young in service, which was to run the Met's homicide and serious crime command. So I was in charge of basically the murder squads in the Met, and then they added on in the latter part of my service the investigation of child abuse and the investigation of rape and serious sexual offences. And that is another conversation all in its own right. I guess what we're talking about today is promotion and how you get there. Just prior to that, I'd been a chief superintendent in a borough of London, which is called Lambeth, which to those of the Met will probably know it. And then to those of the Met who know a little bit about the history of the Met, I was the chief superintendent on Brixton Division, which was the sort of biggest, hardest, roughy, toughest place to work in the Met, and absolutely adored that. My service prior to that had largely been in and out of the CID and investigation, and predominantly across West London. I'd been an SIO on a very early iteration of a homicide squad. I'd run a shift in Hounslow. I'd been a sergeant on an operational relief in Southall, and I'd been a constable in Shepherd's Bush and on a burglary squad in Shepherd's Bush. And I also, just to finish working backwards a bit, I joined back in 1982 under something called the Graduate Entry Scheme, which was one of those very early iterations of the organisation trying to recruit people in on a so-called fast track. There were not many graduates at that time. And there was this sort of incentive, if that's the right word, for you to join under a national scheme and get selected. There were about 20 of us, I think, selected in a year across the country to join different forces. And we tended something which was desperately, scarily called the special course, which is probably the worst title I've ever had of any course that I've been on. So I enjoyed that. My point is, though, I joined as a sort of fast tracker. So to some extent, the subject we're talking about, promotion, the first bit, I still had to pass the exams and earn my spurs and get my credibility, but it was not, it was sort of done to me from about inspector onwards. I was hunting with everybody else around the pool of getting promoted. So that's a little bit about me. That's why I'm here, and that's why I'm sort of got a few things that I'd like to share about what my view is, which I would also add, as you probably frequently say, Steve, isn't right necessarily, but it's my view.
And I think that's a really important part, because I don't think aspiring officers, and that's the point I'd like to start, the first theme, if you like, the aspiration to lead. I don't think that many aspiring officers, certainly when they start out on the promotion process, do understand all the perspectives and context around it. And to a certain extent, they don't need to, and that's hopefully what we're going to talk about. But what I would like to do is just cover a couple of aspects around. So you start with this aspiration to lead, and that's where I started with Rank Success, is around supporting the leadership aspirations that police officers had and helping them to convert that aspiration into promotion success. And that's still a bit of a journey that I'm on at the moment. But just to set the scene, and I'm sure it's always been the same, this theme of a postcode lottery across forces of promotion selection processes. So unsurprisingly, between 43 plus forces, yeah, there are a wide variety of different tests and processes, and a mix and match approach between, you know, competency applications, where you've got to write out a full list of your evidence and examples that make you suitable for promotion to be considered as a first step. Paper sifts, or a letter to the chief constable to explain why should you be promoted, and clearly it's a competitive situation. There's psychometric tests, briefings, presentations. And then you've also got these set against a background of frameworks. And over recent years, those have changed from the policing professional framework through, and the Met's had, I think, three of its own, the Metropolitan Leadership Framework, Metropolitan Policing Framework, and now they all share the competency and values framework. So for some people, you know, promotion seen as a riddle wrapped in a puzzle inside an enigma kind of thing. I'm not sure, to paraphrase Churchill, I've got those all in the right order, but what I wanted to do is just articulate on their behalf through this podcast that there's a lot of frustration amongst them, and they've fed back their feedback to their forces, to their chief constables, through their HR departments around, you know, we don't like applications. They tend to favour people who are good at applications. We don't like them. We don't want them. Here's a cacophony. Take them away. And chief constables have listened to that, and they've done away with them. They've done away with interviews as well. And there are separate arguments around these points. What I wanted to do is say they're listening, but what are your thoughts about this? And is there such a thing as a holy grail for the promotion process? Is there such a thing?
I think there is, Steve. I think there is a, you know, between all of those things you've mentioned and all of those things you've suggested and all the history of events and different forces doing different things, I think there's a couple of things which are consistent to all of them, and probably for the interest of the people who are listening to this podcast, you know, there are things you can do something about. So let me answer that in a couple of ways. First is that my aspiration to leadership, and that's a great way of phrasing it instead of this rather bland word promotion. But my aspiration to leadership was in different regimes. It was, you know, in the pure nepotism, as it was in the early days of my service in the Met, where you passed a knowledge exam, and if you came high up the list, then you got promoted, no matter how good or bad you were. And then from about after inspector, then became a sort of series of beauty contests, promotion boards, and then I remember this thing came along called Osprey, Objective Structured Performance, anyway, whatever it was, Osprey. And I was an Osprey assessor right at the beginning. And that was the first time that the service as a whole had tried to actually put in place, knowledge. So I think there was always an exam. But then you had to do this displaying your competencies in a very sort of contrived environment. And then it was often followed up. Osprey 1 and 2 was absolutely the same up and down the country. And then Osprey 3 became whatever individual forces wanted it to be. But actually what was interesting about that Osprey 1, and we're talking back mid-80s here, mid-late 80s, what was interesting about Osprey 1 and 2 was it had at its core, right, we think these are the competencies that our good leaders should have, and we think that these scenarios allow you, in a slightly contrived way, to display whether you've got those competencies or not. And of course, the risk around that whole process was it became a bit of a, you learned how to display the competencies, even though you could do them or not. What I think was interesting was that however people thought it was easy, when they went into that environment and they were under, if you like, under the scope of performing, nerves kicked in and people sort of forgot what it was they were supposed to be doing and sort of momentarily kicked back to actually being themselves. And that was so obvious when you were sitting on the other side of the table. You could tell when someone was switching out of, I'm in prepared mode, this is what I'm going to say. And then all of a sudden, whack, back they went into instinctively how they were. And so the trick was, and the advice we used to give people when they went through those sessions way back then, was think clearly in your head what the competencies are. Recognize them in your own personal and professional life. And here's the really hard bit. Know when you're doing them and know when you're displaying them under pressure. And so what then happened is if you could do all that and you could practice and you could rehearse and you could prepare all that, you were fairly sure to actually get through the one and two. But your broader point about, you know, the lottery, it's always been a real challenge for organisations, let alone police organisations, to try and recruit its or develop its leaders in a way that it wants to reflect the organisation should be. And that starts with promotion processes, because that's where you filter out who's going to become a leader and who isn't going to become a leader. And I can't in any way defend or even excuse the fact that it was all over the place. You know, what people listening in are saying, this is a complete bloody lottery. Well, to some extent, they're right. But actually, the thing that I feel in slight defense of that situation is that organizations are always trying to get what they think are the best leaders. And they're always trying to do the best they can to actually put a test in place so they can select who those best leaders are.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you understand that and what's going on, so as long as you recognize what the force is actually trying to do, and part of your preparation, I would always say, is always try and figure out what it, you know, why your force has come to the process that it's chosen, or why it's after those particular competencies as well, why it's making you jump through this hoops. Get beyond they're doing it because, you know, it's difficult or it's some whim. Invariably it isn't. There's always some sort of science behind it or some sort of philosophy behind it. Understand that, and then you're halfway through to the process. And it, in my view, it's a completely different way of preparing. You're not practicing your knowledge, you're not making sure that you know what action sections are or you know what to do in certain operational situations. You're sort of trying to understand what type of leader your organization is trying to get. And first of all, thinking, can I be that type of leader? Well, no. If you get to the point of actively pursuing a promotion process, you obviously think that. But if it's, once you sort of get to the point of understanding what type of leader they're looking for, then you're halfway there, because then you can just go back to, okay, well, how do I, as a potential leader in the organization, display to the organization what the organization is looking for? And you can do that in all sorts of ways.
Okay. And in terms of preparation, obviously people listening to this blog will want to know, you've been sat outside the interview room, no doubt, throughout your career on a number of occasions. And so whilst processes change over time and the needs of the organisation change and leadership issues change, what kind of themes or tips would you offer people that are consistent about effective preparation for a promotion process?
Okay. A couple of things, really. First is, and this may seem a bizarre answer in some way, The biggest lesson you can have in any promotion process is when you fall over in it. And I say that because I have, on a number of occasions in my service, I had a couple of times where I went into a promotion process, and for one reason or another, there was one particular occasion, the link between inspector and chief inspector, where I was undone by pure nepotism and somebody making a real quick judgment around me that took me from being sort of top of a list to halfway down the list, which put me outside the, going on to the next phase, or alternatively turning up at what's called a strategic command course interview, which is the ultimate beauty contest of all because it's so full of nonsense, but not necessarily playing the game and getting involved in an argument with the chief constable who was assessing me. Actually, I ended up telling him that I had more operational officers under my command than him, which was just plain stupid, really. So quite rightly, I got my feet slapped and come back next year when you've learned a bit of humility type of stuff, which was, entirely my own fault. So that, we all do these things, we all go into these processes, we all make mistakes, but actually all of those taught me a lot more about my own personal resilience and made me reflect a little bit more about how I was myself. So that's the first big tip, is really understand who you are, and really understand who you are, and ask people who know you what they think you are. Ask colleagues at work, ask friends, ask family, ask your partner, whatever, ask your kids. That's the most savage one of the lot. What do you think I am? It's a really hard question to answer, but don't assume that how you think of yourself is how other people see you. So be brave in actually trying to go through that process. And then reflect a little bit on potentially where you could have done things better. If if you've not been successful in one process, well, don't, for goodness sake, go into the process doing exactly the same thing again. That's just stupid, really. You just have to think, do I understand why I wasn't successful, and what can I do to address it? And so, know yourself, learn from your experience, and then the third bit, and I know from chatting to you informally that this is something you're a really strong advocate of. There's all sorts of things about which give you a clue as to how to prepare. So they talk to you about, you've got to give a briefing, you've got to reflect false policy, you've got to be able to demonstrate, some controversial stuff around your understanding of diversity or transgender issues and all the rest of it. Well, the answers around all that stuff is there. You've just got to, part of your preparation is to think through some of those things, have a go at thinking, how would I answer that question, then play it back to yourself and say, does that actually answer the question? If it doesn't, how do I find out? And there's loads of stuff around. And yes, preparation can also be about sitting in a dark room and trying to understand everything that you need to get the answer to. But actually, more importantly, preparation is around focusing really hard on what it is that you're being asked to do in the process and preparing yourself for that. So there's three things then. Know yourself, learn from experience, and prepare properly.
Okay, thanks very much. And I'm sure the listeners will find some really good insights into that from your experience. And of course, you alluded to the fact that processes have changed, from the olden days, or the not so good days of nepotism, through to the more kind of scientific approaches through Osprey, etc. And again, even at those times, people used to say, well, Osprey favours those that are good at role play, those are good at remembering. And that feedback is a common theme. But like you just said, I think learning from knockbacks and setbacks, you either want to aspire to be a leader, and you're prepared to take the knocks and the setbacks that go with that. So there's a degree of resilience with that. And some of the language I've seen that some of the previous Met, Metropolitan, just to focus on that bit before, but it's a common theme throughout. And I like some of the honesty in there, which is that I've seen in some of the literature, which is, you know, are you exceptional? Are you driven? Are you focused? Are you enthusiastic? Are you motivated? Because if you're not, well, don't think about going for promotion, because it's only going to need more of you in terms of reserves. Yeah. So with that in mind, and the selection processes that are employed, I just wanted to kind of pitch this to you. In terms of, there are officers in the organisation, including introverts, neurodiversity is coming to the fore now, where many organisations are starting to recruit. So people with neurodiverse conditions, so on the autism spectrum, yeah, dyslexia, dyspraxia. Yeah. And organisations are realising that they need to tap into that diversity that's held there. Do you think that things like interviews, which form a staple part or a key component of interviews in most force processes, are still an effective tool to select leaders at various levels? And can you imagine a time where you don't use an interview?
Okay, so an interview is an interesting process, Steve. Can I just preface, I will answer the question. I promise I will answer the question, but I need to just put two contexts around it before I sort of tell you what I think about the interview. I think there's two huge myths in terms of promotion. First is, and I'll just use the first promotion process in the service, it's constable to sergeant, but actually it applies all the way up the chain, frankly, to chief constable. But that move from constable to sergeant, it's first myth is that people who are good constables automatically make good sergeants. And that is completely a myth. Normally, there's lots of characteristics in good cops, constables, which actually, if they, can turn into good sergeants. But you have really good examples both ways. Good constables who become very poor sergeants, and good sergeants who were poor constables. And you know that's the first thing to say, and you can talk about that forever. The second thing to say is that, in my mind, there's the second biggest myth is you've got to have loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of service or gone through all sorts of experience before you feel you're competent and capable to become a supervisor and a leader. I absolutely think people have got to be operationally competent, and I absolutely think that people have got to feel the fierce heat of, you know, thinking under pressure, making decisions under pressure, being a bit streetwise, and all those sort of things which go to make, you know, being able to deal with operational situations. Well, you've got to have some of that, and you've got to have that experience, but people will learn and pick it up at different degrees. But the number of times that I came across people in my service where you had someone who'd got two people who got 10 years service, one had got 1 year service 10 times over, and one had got a gradual progression throughout their 10 years of doing different things. So that, you know, your length of time of doing something isn't always the good indicator of your competence in doing it. Put those two together, difference between PC and sergeant, and your competence over time. Which then brings me to the interview. Because, you know, there's a couple of things happen in interviews, in my humble opinion, is that because of the pressure that's presented by them, the first sort of differential between success and failure is those who manage the occasion best. There's an interesting sporty analogy here, sorry, just to digress a little bit, that there's all these thousands of young people that start out as really good technical footballers. You know, when all these kids go through academies and all the rest of it, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of them. They're all pretty good. They're all skillful and all the rest of it. There's this very tiny pool of them that actually make it in the end. And I think I've heard sports coaches and football clubs say that actually what makes a difference is that those that make it, have all the skills, but they actually learn how to manage. They can cope with the occasion. They can cope with just playing on a football pitch in front of nobody to playing in, you know, a couple of thousand people or, you know, tens of thousands of people, and all the pressure that goes with that. They deal with that, and then they can still display their skills. Well, that analogy is exactly the same for an interview. When people go into an interview situation, they go into a pressurized situation, they go into something that's slightly artificial, something that's engineered to actually put you slightly on edge. There's a big piece of feedback about how you learn to manage to cope with that tension, but nonetheless, it plonks you down in front of or in a circumstance that you're on a slightly vulnerable edge, and then it tests you out and it asks you to do things. And again, I can only, it's my experience of sitting on the other side of the table on quite a few occasions, is that pretty quickly you can tell who's coping with that stress and pressure and who's not. And one of the basic things around leadership in some ways is, you know, that leadership is a lot about managing situations and keeping a clear head when all others around you and turn and look at you. And classically, you know, what I always used to say to newly promoted sergeants that I saw is, you've now gone from, you know, what do we do? You know, I've not a clue. Someone needs to tell me what I'm doing, to people turning around to you and saying, well, what do we do now, Sarge? And it's a big leap. It's a very pressurized situation. And you've got to be able to cope with that. You've got to be able to think in a common sense way. You've got to be able to display that wisdom. You've got to display all the characteristics of ethics and values and do the right thing and all that sort of stuff. Because there's a lot of pressure on you as a frontline supervisor to make the right decision. Well, in some sort of ways, that's what goes on in an interview. And how people cope with that pressure is a good thing. And the ability to cope with that pressure is probably a fundamental first step in discerning, is this person going to be a good leader or not? Where I think it sometimes goes wrong is that it becomes too predictable a process. So I'm a little bit uneasy with the interview scenario that allows people who've worked out what the system is just to say the things which get the ticks in the boxes. I'm sure that does happen. I'd be surprised if, you know, most interview processes haven't thought of a way of getting around that. And it's very rare that it will just be purely and simply, we've created the scenario, they're going to tick the boxes, we get them through. I think there's always got to be an element of unpredictability in it, which takes you a little bit away from people who have just, you know, ticking the boxes and ticking the boxes. So that's a long roundabout way of saying, Steve, that I know it's not necessarily a perfect product, but an interview, because it's a pressurized situation, is quite a good environment that discerns and is able to make a judgment about how good people are or not, as well as being, do I know what to say when I'm supposed to say it?
Okay, and in terms of, you know, as I said, people with perhaps neurodiverse condition, because I say that because it's a big theme at the moment, so diversity, equality, inclusion, I think Kent Police, Essex Police, I think Kent Police has got a diversity and inclusion academy that they've just started now. I think some forces are starting to have a pre-interview before your interview for your promotion board. You have a pre-interview where they ask you diversity, equality and inclusion based questions as part of looking at that leadership that you will deliver and support the culture that is expected in the organisation at that time. But on a broader team, obviously, it's important for on a broader theme, it's important on a number of other issues. But do you think that an interview should be, to be fair to candidates who are equally good at things like situational judgment tests, psychometric tests, do you think it should form part of a mix and match, and that the weighting is kind of eased or alleviated in relation to the interview perspective in those circumstances? Because I know forces are falling over themselves to try and make systems fairer all the time. And they're experimenting. So things like providing questions in advance. Certainly never heard of in my time. So 10 minutes before you come on the board, while you sat outside the door, here are the six questions you're going to be asked around the competences you're going to be assessed on, all the values that are at play here. Allowing people a break, so people who are under pressure or perhaps don't come across well with their non-verbal things, and that may be misread in human terms by a board. You're looking bored or you're looking preoccupied with the questions. So and providing a paper and pen just to make some notes. Do you think those are fair adjustments could help?
I do think we've come a long way from just assuming that people can just get on with it, and if you can't cope, you know, can't take the heat, get out the kitchen. We come a long way from that, and you know, in your and our day, that was probably how it was done, and we had to sink or swim. And you know, it's a horrible phrase which I just use, for example, my kids or you know, younger people in the when I was in the service, that you know, it didn't do us any harm. I mean, that's actually a load of nonsense, really, because in some ways, while it didn't perhaps do you and I any harm, and we survived and came through, there were lots of other people who got quite badly burnt by that, and some capable people who could have got along with us that got knocked out by the system, which says, oh, you know, you should be able to do this because we're a big, roughy-tufty organisation, you should be able to cope with pressure. So there's nothing wrong with actually trying to get a bit behind, despite what I said earlier, the management of people's nerves. Nothing wrong with that at all. And giving people an opportunity to be able to get over some of the more sort of superficial things which may inhibit their performance in that interview is a good thing. And I would also add as well that all this focus on, I don't know, diversity and you know, what does to become more reflective of the society that we live in. Well, you know, in my mind, I think it was when Robert Peel started us all off in 1829, and I still think it's the same now. I certainly teach it at university when I talk about on the policing degree, you know, the Robert Peel's principles, the police are the people and the people are police. And society generally is now recognising, bumpily and chaotically and controversially, that we ought to be more inclusive in saying there are people out there who, for one reason or another, could potentially offer huge amounts to the organisation who we're excluding out. So, you know, you take those two controversial issues of disability and race. So disability, so a load of people who have physical or invisible disabilities who potentially just can't get through the hoops, dyslexia being one. You know, you just can't get through the hoops. And so there's a bit, you can never be sure as an organisation that talent of that individual hasn't been stopped purely by simply because of their their disability. And likewise, the issue of race. You know, we are now, I speak for London. That's the only environment that I'm pretty well acquainted with and understand. But, you know, London is a hugely diverse and cosmopolitan and multicultural city. And, you know, yet there's large groups of that population who, for a bunch of reasons, you know, and this is not the time to discuss or debate why, there's all sorts of reasons why, but for a bunch of reasons, don't see joining the police as a particular option. Well, you just cut out a bunch of people who could potentially, never mind, you know, the issue around their race, but they could actually become really good cops and, you know, they could enrich your service and all the rest of it. And so it seems common sense that you'd reach out to groups of people who you hadn't reached out to before, just to see if there was a way of at least getting them to have a fighting chance to get through the process. The other point I think that you're hinting at around the sort of pre-board, so in other words, the force putting candidates through a process which tests out their awareness and understanding of matters related to diversity, etc., before they go on to the, if you like, the main event. Well, again, that's probably a bit reflective of the fact that if you sit back and look at the whole thing objectively, there isn't a lot of movement, or there isn't sufficient movement in how the police service deals well in the public perception with those sort of things. So that you can either turn around and say, well, I don't really, you know, the police forces can either say, well, I don't really care what you think. We know what's right. We're doing our best. Leave us alone. Or you can accept the fact that people are still saying, you need to do more, you need to do more, you need to do more to challenge this, you need to get on top of that, and all the rest of it. Incidentally, that's what policing in a democracy looks like. And it's bumpy, and it's horrible, and it's uncomfortable, and it seems unfair. And, you know, I've had more than my fair share of being vilified by, in a public domain, totally unfairly. But actually, what I would reflect on myself is that's what policing in, you know, that's why, you know, policing by consent and policing a democracy lives like. I don't suppose I'll make a big stereotypical judgment here. Police in, I don't know, Russia or some other autocratic country really care what the public think. Well, actually, we do here. And that's the difference between living here and living there. So when the public do intrude and become sometimes a bit unreasonable and excessive and uninformed and all the rest of it, and say, we want you to do more, well, then the job of the police is to sort of say, okay, take on board that and try and do something about it. And so maybe these are about forces saying, right, we're going to have to try and actually make sure that we've got a baseline of understanding of people, of our potential leaders, and we just want to reassure ourselves that our leaders are thinking and are directed and bluntly realise the significance and the importance of this issue to us, and how we are as an organisation, and most importantly, how important it is to the public that we're there to serve. Remember that, it's that way round. It's not us. You know, you and I were not in this job purely because it served us. We're in the job because we serve the public. And so it's not unreasonable for forces to reach out on that. Either way, whether it's unreasonable or not, I think the reality is it's happening. And the reality, it is now an issue to be thought through and prepared for. And, you know, think about it a bit, there is absolutely no difference in my mind at all between the way that you prepare yourself for, if you like, the professional part of the interview, from the way that you prepare yourself for the filter part of the interview, i.e. can you just check out that you're aware and understanding of what, you know, how serious we are about this issue around diversity? You know, understand the issue, understand where it comes from. Those things I was talking about, you know, why is the police force sort of excluding great swathes of people that potentially could be quite good, quite helpful and supportive and expand the way that the police develop, the service develops? You know, understand all that sort of stuff. Understand where it's coming from, why it's happening. Because if you understand it, then you will know what's expected of you as a leader, and you will be able to ask yourself the question, can I do that? And again, my experience is most people can, most people do. I mean, there's some people that have inbuilt and innate prejudices and sort of, you know, just won't move with that. Well, my suggestion to them is think very carefully about whether you want to become a leader or not. Because the other thing about leadership is you've got a whole load of additional expectations on you that if you don't want to have them, well, you don't have to. So, you know, get off the process. Go back to, you know, what you feel comfortable with and what you do professionally and well. But leadership carries with it a whole load of additional responsibilities and expectations and accountabilities, not least of which is You have to set the proper example to those that you are leading. And you're one of the many, many things you have a responsibility is to ensure that those you are leading deliver the type of service that the public would expect. And it's sometimes quite hard. So therefore, having a basic awareness and understanding of what you think about that seems to me to be a logical thing that forces can look for in candidates.
Okay, thanks so much. And thanks for going into some depth in that response, because I think it'll provide some value, certainly to officers. And I think there's at least one force that's doing pre-interviews, so a pre-board for those reasons before they do a board. And you've shared some really good insights into why they might do that and the thinking behind it. There was just one theme before I'd come to the final one.
Yeah.
That, as a result of what you've just said, I just wanted to say, you mentioned you contribute and teaching on a degree course, a policing degree course, and we talked about diversity and perhaps excluding swathes or proportions of people from joining policing. How do you think those two things sit?
Steve, I know we've talked about this before, and I the listeners to think, well, now you're on a, you know, here's I'm going to probably sound a bit hypocritical as someone who joined the police back in the early 80s as under something called the graduate entry scheme as one of the very, very few graduates in the service. I've got a law degree. That's wonderfully useful when you're trying to work out whether someone's having you over, and this guy that you've stopped in the street, who you think is a street robber, whether or not you're going to put your hands in his pocket or let him wait until he runs off. Or, you know, so having a law degree didn't make the ha'porth worth of difference. And of course, I had to learn like everybody else in terms of whether that was a good idea or was that was a bad idea. That's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is I'm sort of a little bit uncomfortable, and I can say this because I'm on your podcast, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the way that, you know, the particular political party that is responsible for us now has had it sort of a bit of a mission to leverage the entry into police to be degree led. I'm a little bit uncomfortable with that, and I think it's going to it's going to have some consequences down the line, which I don't quite know what are going to look like. But I suggest it is, and I'm also uncomfortable for added value with the notion of direct entry, superintendent, inspector, direct entry. I'm all for having an alternative view of the world. But I'm also, despite everything I've said, a deep traditionalist in that I think Robert Peel, you know, envisaged that all of us would work our way up from constable to chief constable. And, you know, I genuinely treasure my frontline operational service as a constable, sergeant and inspector to a certain degree. And how that shaped and moulded me as a professional later in my life. So that gets that sort of prejudice out of the way. On the technical side of the degree entry, one of the interesting things we're doing the direct entry or the degree holder entry program, but we're also doing the apprentice route. So you know. In some ways, it's a normal entry into the police, and then to qualify and get operationally competent when you come out the other side, you go through the apprentice degree level. And one of the things that the degree level stuff does do, in its defence, is it gets officers to reflect a little bit more on why they're doing something, where the history of that particular requirement to do something comes from and what it's for. Now, those sound like really grand answers, and you know, you could quite rightly say, well, operational frontline cops haven't got time to be faffing around with all that sort of stuff. They got to make a decision there and then on what's in front of them. But actually, instinctively, and I do a lot about, teach a lot with you, Steve, about decision-making and the quality of decision-making and how you are able to recognise a context that you're operating in and the rationale that you've applied to a decision and when you make a decision. Actually, the quality of decision-making can only be improved by getting people to understand their context a bit better. So that is a benefit of the degree-led entry. Your point, though, is does that exclude a bunch of people who might not necessarily be in that sort of academic mindset? Well, the answer is yes, it does. I do think the apprentice, the PCDA part, route into the degree tries to address that in some ways. I'm not sure it will be entirely successful. And that's a long way of saying, as this way of selecting now gets deeply more embedded, and make no mistake, there's no going back on this. The politicians that have put this in place have embedded it so deeply now that we ain't going to go back to how we were before. So in some ways, we've just got to try and live with it and develop it to suit what the services needs are. But there will be some people who will be excluded out of that. Yes, and that's a risk. It is a risk, and it's part of a sort of, you know, there's pros and cons around this. That's definitely one of the cons. But my broader point as well, is there also some pros in it as well. There's also some advantages to this degree-led selection or training process.
Okay, thanks very much for that. And I know it's a big subject and we could probably talk all day on it, but thanks for those insights. And just finally, before we finish, there's probably sergeants listening going for inspector and inspectors listening going for chief inspector. Would you just kind of share with us some insights and thoughts, perhaps a bit of reflection around the transition points between those ranks? So clearly, if you're going from sergeant to inspector into the inspecting ranks, yeah, very much around inspecting standards. Then there's the decision to be made when you go for chief inspector, because on the face of it, you know, financially it's not worth it. It's a definite step,
yeah,
depending on what period of policing you're in, because they've done away with the rank and promoted,
yeah,
people,
yeah,
rank skipping, etc. And yeah, I appreciate all of that is part of experimentation and selecting the right leaders and experimenting with processes.
Yeah.
The point being really is, you know, for those that are listening, what would be your kind of key thoughts around those transitions between those ranks?
Okay, first and foremost, Steve, and we've talked about this before, the hardest jump in the whole service is between PC and sergeant. It's the biggest jump because, in my view, and I used to say this to, you know, hundreds of newly promoted sergeants that came to work for me, is you've gone from being, you know, a deliverer, someone with huge responsibility to make things happen and get it done and sorted out, to a leader. And you're no longer one of the gang, because, you know, there's me sitting as a pretty senior leader in the organisation. You're my first level of supervision because you're a supervisor. And all that goes with that, you know, you have to make, it's easy enough to do the follow me, let's go over the top, I'm a bit of a hero, I can do this really well, follow my example. That's relatively easy to do. The hardest bit is to do is you can't do that. I want you to behave in this way, not that. Why did you do that? That sort of stuff is really hard to do. So that, you know, that's the first real test in leadership. Having said that, it's also extremely stimulating and really interesting and really exciting. And it gives you a whole new perspective on how the organisation works, a whole new perspective on how policing is delivered. And actually, when you're doing it as well, there's a fantastic, there's a fantastic excitement. It's a bit clumsy as a phrase. It's really exciting. It's really stimulating. It's really interesting. It gives you a whole new perspective on how the job that you presumably love doing because you're seeking to develop yourself in it, and how the job works, and and more importantly, how it works well. Your question, though, sergeant, inspector, chief inspector, and all that sort of stuff. Well, I think I think there does come a point in a leadership cycle when your leadership skills will develop and they'll pass from the sort of frontline tactical supervision to the more, this is a horrible phrase, strategic leadership oversight. So I think if you have leadership aspirations, and more importantly, you have leadership skills, you will reach a point when those leadership skills themselves need to develop. And actually, if you think about it in leadership terms, the only logical way you can do that is to put yourself in a different strata of leadership in the organization. So you go from, when you go from sergeant to inspector, when you go from inspector to chief inspector, on each occasion, you're going a little bit further up the chain, your perspective is getting wider, the breadth of what you've got in front of you is getting broader, the understanding of the relevance of frontline tactical stuff to organizational strategy, that sounds like a load of nonsense, doesn't it? But you sort of know what I mean, is getting greater. So as you go further up the chain, you'll need to think about and take the bigger picture and influence the organization more and adapt and, you know, get things done and achieved across the bigger scale. The need and your own desire and your own interest in doing that is going to develop. And so it is entirely logical in some ways, if that's what floats your boat. So if you are serious about leadership and you do think you have leadership skills and you think you've done them well and you think you can do them better and you think the organisation values and you think you're in tune with what the organisation wants, well then the great opportunity is to go and develop them even further in another context to another extent. And that actually, just in police service terms, happens to coincide with this slightly hierarchical move up the ranks. The one thing I think everybody will have, and I had it, and I'll be completely honest, I reached the point in my service, and this is going to sound a bit weird and strange to, you know, people who are constables and sergeants and what have you, but I reached the point when I was a commander stroke assistant chief constable where I thought, you know, I really don't want to go on to the next phase. Because it may seem bizarre, but the next stage up in the Met, you know, become a DAC, a Deputy Assistant Commissioner, was you had little or no interaction with anything that looked vaguely like tactical options. So I loved what I did in terms of, you know, although I was in charge of it all, I still had that real buzz of an excitement of being in charge of, you know, the Met's murder squads or the Met's rape squads or whatever. Still knew I had that interface and that operation. It was, I still saw some reality in terms of my day-to-day existence. I knew if I made that next hop up, I probably could have done the job reasonably well, I should think. I think I'd been encouraged to do for it, but I just realized, literally, as I was filling in the form to apply for the promotion process, and I suddenly put the pen down and thought, I can't do this. And my wife asked me, well, why are you doing it? You seem to like this job you're doing now. Why are you seeking to go to another one? And she was absolutely correct. What's the point? So I think we can all reach at different times that time when you're at your maximum stimulus. And in that particular case, I saw that I had, you know, 4 or 5 years left until I got to 30-year service, where I was going to be doing what I was doing then at the level and style to which I'd done before. And as the commissioner told me when I went to say to him I wasn't going to be applying for that process, he said, well, you know, I totally respect that decision, but you have hopped off the escalator and, you know, other people are coming up on the escalator and it's really difficult, if not impossible, to get back on. Fine, I don't really care about that point. And I don't regret that for a second. The point, though, is that I'd reached that point where I jumped off the escalator. So I think you can move, you will know, sounds very grand this and probably quite ancient and a bit patronising, but you will know in your own life when you reach that point, when you, you know, you're at the need for further stimulus is no longer there, and you can just get just as much of a buzz out of where you are. You might decide, particularly after listening to me ramble on, that you want to stay as a constable the rest of your service. Great, fantastic. Genuinely, the police service is the rock of the police service, is that overwhelming proportion, I don't know what it is in percentage terms, who remain, become constables and remain constables for the whole of their service. Constables, detective constables. They are the rock on which the organisation is built, and to whom all the efforts and energy of any leader or manager is have a responsibility to support. But if you hop on that next phase up and you become a sergeant, then you'll probably pretty quickly find your leadership skills need recalibrating, stimulating, challenging, and you can probably think, you know, I could do this as well. And provided you keep that mindset and keep going, sky's your limit.
Okay, thanks so much. And I recognise a lot of what you say, and clearly you're talking about experiences at senior leadership level. I recognise a lot of the insights from what you say from coaching people at various levels, particularly where we have those conversations around, is this what you want? What are the reasons for that?
Yeah.
What's stopping you? Coaching questions that are kind of there to help people develop their thinking. And some people have. I've even coached people that have decided to leave the police.
Yeah.
So having that moment to stop and think it through is really important. And thanks very much for your time today in allowing other people to stop. So if you're walking your dog listening to this, or if you're commuting, or you're driving your car, as many people listen to my dulcet pommy tones, then hopefully you've got Simon's to kind of mix in with it. And to use these podcasts to think and to reflect through your next steps, and to decide if you do not to take the next one, or at least delay or defer it for a while. But thank you for listening. And Simon, thanks ever so much. I know you've missed your train for this one, or you've delayed your train to go home.
Yeah, no,
really appreciate
Steve,
it.
Steve, it's been great. I mean, your listeners will probably gather, I love to speak, and sometimes I just get carried around with my own voice. I absolutely am 100% passionate about helping people to develop and move on. And if doing this in any way sets off a chain of thought in someone's head, which actually helps them to make their mind up about what they want to do, then it's been worth every second of it. And if it gets any decent feedback, I'll talk about anything. And we maybe come back and chat about some other stuff, if anybody can bear it. But yeah, it's been fun. Enjoy it.
Okay, and just one final thing, because all my listeners will never forgive me if I don't mention it, because I do in some of my other podcasts. I don't think I've ever missed one. If you do decide that you want to take the next steps and you do want to do that quickly, you can download a digital toolkit or a video recorded masterclass just to help you take those next steps and add some momentum to your aspirations. Whatever you choose to do, I wish you the best, and I'll be back with another podcast next week. Thank you.